Hi everybody, I might start, seeing I've been the one telling everybody they've got to be on time today, so at least I can do that. For those of you who don't know me, my name's Leanne Cameron and I work in the School of Education, and I'm currently doing some work with Melco, who look after the lambs. And we've been working with lambs in our teacher education program now for, this will be the fifth semester, so we've had five cohorts through using this system. So I'll just chat about what we're doing, and I've got a couple of colleagues here who've also worked on the program, so any questions, feel free. It's a nice small group, so if you've got questions as we go through, I can't see any problem at all, and you're just shouting them out. We had a re-look at the course about 2.5 years ago and decided... Now, we were really careful to make sure that we could stand on the left side in this room, and I then blew it and stood on the right. Thank you. Okay, so everyone can see? Yes, good. The course rationale. We decided that what we needed to do was to encourage our students to develop this lifelong learning program. And that to do that successfully, the best way was for us to model it. We noticed what we were doing was telling the students that they must develop these lovely constructivist climates for their students, and then what were we doing? We were just simply giving them material in a transition model. So we decided to have a relook at that. And we also wanted our students to realise the potential of Web 2 tools, but to make sure that they weren't just doing it to take advantage of the bells and whistles type, that they were doing it in a pedagogically sound way, and that we weren't just teaching them which buttons to press. We were actually teaching them in a way that when the tool changed, what they learnt in our course was going to move with them. So what we decided to do was we had to design effective learning activities. We wanted to make sure that that relationship between theory, which is what we tended to be pushing at them, had a really clear link to the research that we were bringing in that was up to date, but also the practice that our teacher and education students were going back out into the schools doing. We wanted them to be actively involved because that's what we told them their students wanted. So their own students in schools were supposed to be actively involved in their learning, and we wanted to demonstrate that as well. We wanted to heighten student engagement, and most importantly, we wanted to get them critically thinking and reflecting. Now, we felt we did that anyway with their assignments, but we did notice that in everyday lectures, there wasn't a lot of that happening. Collaborative investigation, another big thing in schools, and again, wasn't happening a great deal in our course. So we wanted to add that as well. And most importantly, because these web tools are very interactive, students are designing their own materials, we wanted our students to be designers as well. Importantly, we wanted them to get into this reuse. And I think we've done that reasonably successfully. And provide lots of opportunities for our students to co-create resources. So just to show you how this has come about, I wanted to show you a sequence. This is a sequence by one of the students on how to buy a mobile phone. It's been used successfully with students in commerce classes, which is year 8 and 9, 14, 15-year-olds in the main. Looking at budgets and ways to budget for their money. This particular sequence she's set up quite well. She's given the students a budget, told them exactly what they need to know about, given them the criteria for the selection of the phone, but then she's introduced some material, a video, that goes through how to choose a phone. And then most importantly, she gets them to talk about it. So in this particular sequence, they do the research first, they all see the same material, but then they discuss what they consider is the most important criteria for their particular purposes. So that's a forum. They then are given three websites. And these websites are put in here so that the students in the schools are not racing off trying to type in URLs and making typing mistakes. They're also directed directly at the correct part of the page, so that some of these web pages are huge, these whole sites. This way it minimises the waffling, getting lost type environment, and they're given three particular sites to go to. This is what the students would see. So they'd see the page that she wants them to go to. In this particular option there, it's the Virgin site. And she's given them a bit of an instruction at the top there. And then they collate that information and put it onto a spreadsheet template that she's developed for them. The students then fill out their template and upload it. And then they go back to a forum and they discuss what it was they did and why they chose what they did. And then afterwards, the assessment was a 300-word reflection on how difficult it was to choose a mobile phone. Now, that was her assignment. This is the sort of thing we used to ask them to do. And you can quite clearly see the difference. This is a lesson plan where a student went through and wrote down all the bits and pieces. And for a lot of our students, the first one is by far preferable to the second. So why do we even get them to do this? Their textbook says that a lesson plan helps them be better prepared for instruction. It also enables them to consider the different options as they're preparing to teach. It helps them with evaluating the lesson afterwards and builds up their confidence because they've stepped through this lesson and prepared it. Now, I actually totally agree with that. I think that new teachers really need to sit down very carefully and work through the steps. But the difference was that what we used to give them, the lesson plan, didn't always do that very well. And our students tended to ask, well, does writing a lesson plan really make my lesson better? If they did it properly, it did. If they didn't do it properly and it was just a piece of paperwork, then no, it didn't make a whole lot of difference to the lesson at all. And the difference was the student's attitude. A written lesson plan done very well does the job. But unfortunately, it was really difficult on a regular basis to get our students to continually do this. Whereas the LAMS lesson, they enthusiastically worked through. So why have we stuck with using LAMS, particularly if we've had over the years varying technical difficulties? Firstly, the scaffolding that it provides for new students. So these are students that have often done very limited teaching. It asks them, when they choose a tool, to provide some material. So that is, they have to stop. Instead of just saying, oh, we'll have a discussion, they have to stop and they have to think about the nature of the question. They have to type it in. They have to provide the web pages instead of thinking, oh, well, maybe I'll just put them on Google and we'll find something. They have to seriously stop and think about what sort of websites that they're looking for. It also allows them to visualise the activity mix. The colours don't come up on that screen, but the activities are colour-coded. So if it's a mainly transition information-based activity, it's one particular colour. So when the students have completed their activity, just by looking at it, they can instantly see whether there's a mix of activity in the sequence. It also, and I think this is one of the strengths, allows them to experience the lesson beforehand as a learner. Now, with your lesson plan, you can work out what you think will happen and how it will roughly look. It might go that way or it might not. This way, they get to experience it as a learner. And the number of times I've seen them develop what they consider the perfect lesson, and then they sit through and preview it as a learner, and it's amazing how many changes they decide to make at that point. It also creates a standardised template. So that means that it allows them to put it in a form that is very readily recognised by other people that use LAMS. And I've got a screenshot there of the LAMS community. And the LAMS community, we're encouraging our students to upload their sequence, even though they don't think it's perfect. And I think this is the key. Many of our students were reluctant at first to put their work up because they thought they'd be judged. I've given up trying to get teachers to do this because teachers are shocking. They will not put their work up because they think their colleagues will say, oh, they think that's pretty good, do they? Well, I think it's terrible. But my students will often do it. And I tell them, even if it's not perfect, it's often used as inspiration by someone else. And the ability for it to be readily edited is a huge plus here. So you can actually download. And Pam Kelly's looking at LAMS Community a bit later. So if you haven't looked at LAMS Community before, you might like to visit her. And the big plus from our point of view is because this method produces more than documentations, our students will actually do it. And this applies not just to e-lessons, that is, lessons involving the internet. We were finding students were increasingly working through with offline activities as well. So the current version of LAMS, which is version 2, allows for online and offline activities. So the students could work through both methods, upload worksheets if they want. It kept it all together so that next time when they used it, the lesson was all there, ready to go, parceled up in a format. What we did was we got the students to roughly get their sequence together and then to bring it to class. And as a group, in pairs, small groups, they're encouraged to workshop it. And I think this was a really, really interesting exercise because the students that really took advantage of this suddenly realised the difference in learning styles out there. That even in a classroom of fairly similar students quite frequently, there was a whole lot of different interpretations. And these collective sequences became much, much stronger and of a much higher quality when the whole group got together and started working through. So these sessions were really, really good, and the students found that they were incredibly valuable. It also meant, from a teacher education point of view, that we didn't have three biggest essays, which in a way was basically how we tended to test our students in our courses. We tended to have lots of essays, so we tended to be marking them for how well they were essay writing all the time, repeatedly. And I'm not by any stretch of the imagination saying that I don't believe teachers should write well, because I certainly do, but we were actually testing the same thing over and over again. So this gave us a very different way of assessment. And possibly not surprisingly, the students that did extremely well in this activity were not always the ones that did extremely well in their essay task. This was probably a more reflective guide to us of how effective these students were going to be in the classroom. So it was quite interesting. So this, in a way, was a much more authentic task. Now, the benefits that they came back to us with using their LAMS sequence in their schools, because they often created a sequence while they were out visiting schools, and then they went off and they trialled it. They liked the fact that they could use the internet in a classroom, but they had some control. That is, that everything was ready to go. The URL wasn't an issue, the typing in caps wasn't a problem, they didn't have to learn these great long strings of letters to type in. Secondly, they were in this little contained environment, and if the students just clicked through, you knew they were moving in where you expected them to. It allowed you to step it through. And it's this sequence of learning activities which has become the strength. You can control the order of activities. Now, sometimes it's irrelevant, and in that case, you can do an entire sequence of optional activities whereby the students do anything in any order, and that's perfectly valid. But in some cases, particularly in mine where I like to have a dramatic effect, It's really important to have the sequence done the way it was designed to do. And so this is something that the students are now playing with. It also allows for controlled self-pacing lessons. There is always those students that just scoot through. They know the material quite well, but they can go at their own pace. They can push themselves if that's required, but it is much more individualised. And the strength of the whole system, I think, is that it makes group work much more manageable. We have a series of discussions in this course. We can have small group lessons where groups are discussing. They know that we can see what they're discussing. So rather than have that situation where I used to have was we had group discussions and as I walked away from their group, they started talking about something else. And as I walked around, suddenly they got on task and I left again and they went off. This way, because everything they're saying, typing in, is recordable, the group work is manageable as well. I'm looking forward to the new branching feature whereby the students can be branched into groups, do tasks within their group, and then be brought back into the whole, which is coming very, very soon. This afternoon, I'm told. And this class discussion can't be underestimated. We used to have general class discussions whereby a tutor of about 20 students was to do a certain number of readings. The idea was that they then came to class and discussed it. This is not a revolutionary idea. I think universities do this all over the place. The problem was that we found that I was talking to myself or two or three students on a regular basis. Now, that's not to say the other students in the group hadn't done the reading. I would like to think they had. It's just that they didn't contribute. And often they got into a pattern of knowing those three or four students were going to be the ones that carried the discussion, so they sat back. Now, again, they might have learnt lots in that room, but I really couldn't say at the end of the lesson whether they were or not. If you pointedly ask questions, particularly if they're non-English speaking background students, the embarrassment and horror on their face made you feel that you really put them on the spot. When we've moved to, we use three now, online, in-class discussions. So that means these students are in a lab with computers and they're online. We have never had an instance where a student has contributed nothing. And that includes the non-English speaking students, because I was most concerned about those students when we started to introduce this, thinking that we were penalising them because they had to be able to write in English. What has turned out is a lot of them find it they're much more comfortable writing it rather than saying it, and allows them also to spell check it in Word if they want and then drop the text in. So where I was concerned we were penalising them, in a lot of cases they're actually relieved to have this part of the conversation. In this particular example, the student names have appeared, but in our previous discussions we were able to run anonymous discussions, and that was of huge benefit to our group. We tend to have two polarised groups in our discussions: the students that have just left school and are going into teaching for their career, and then the mature age students who have been off and done other things and are coming back to train teachers. The mature age students think that the students that have just left school know nothing, and that is reflected when those students open their mouths. However, the students that have just left school think that the mature age students wouldn't have a clue of what it's really like out there, so they come in these discussions with all this baggage. Once we took that away and it became an anonymous discussion, it was really quite interesting to see how much more productive these conversations became. So, what we discovered was that the value of this whole thing was not that we were teaching them to use these technical tools. The fact that we were teaching them to use technology was of advantage. They got used to using technology, but that really wasn't the point. We think that what we're doing now is looking at teaching students how to look at implementing technology in their teaching with a real aim and a pedagogical point to the whole exercise. We're simply not in the business of teaching them the latest technology for technology's sake. There is a definite purpose and an authentic reason for attempting this. So thank you. And if anybody's got any questions? Yes, hi.
Early on in your presentation you talked about the trials and tribulations of implementing, was it implementing the technology or was it using it in the classroom? Can you just clarify what those
are? All of the above, really. We've had, I've got two of the lecturers in the room. When you do this for the first time, yes, you're giggling because you know. It does seem odd to start with. The first thing we usually do in the group is the online discussion in class, and the first time any lecturer new to the course sees that that is something to be done, they just look at you as if to say, well, why do you do that? It only takes one time usually to convince them that that's worthwhile. So those sort of technical issues, the issue of actually working the software I find quite simple to use. The drag and drop design is really good, but it's like anything, even if it's relatively easy to use, it's new. So the authoring tools, particularly in version one, had a few idiosyncratic little things about them that once you've used it for a while, you forget. And these poor new lecturers were saying, what happened to my screen? We were used to it. So those sorts of things happened. The version one had more bugs in it. Version one has more bugs in it than version two. We just don't know the bugs in version two yet. But it seems far more straightforward in that extent. But technically, if you're going to run something live on the internet, you have your heart in your mouth sometimes because, I mean, we've got building works over on that side of the campus, and a bulldozer will go through a cable overnight. Mm-hmm. We had one that was, we turned an exam into an online discussion live, and we had to cancel one session because the whole campus just dropped off, and they had some blowout in one of the big machines, and the whole campus just lost it that day. So you live with that all the time too. And it's just running anything over a network, particularly the first few times, till you get yourself sorted out that there's the issues.
And did you find that the staff and students had an issue with using LAN? Was there one worse than the other? The students, were they picking it up more easily? Like, for example, you know, using the chat. I mean, because I'm sort of expecting, would students say to me, well, why aren't we just using Ampersand?
Yeah, well, the reason I don't use MSN is because I have no history. The chat in LAMS, I keep a history of it. I can see it. It's in monitor. I can see what's going on. And we use it as part of our assessment now. And so if it's MSN, once it's off the screen with MSN, it's gone. You know.
That's right. We get them to copy and paste.
Yeah. Well, this is all there for you, and it's streamed in colour. And I find that really, really useful to get the threads of conversation. We use two different styles. We use forum and chat. Chat, where you've got this chronological, fast-moving thing. As a bit of a gross generalisation, I would say the younger students prefer that method. It's very immediate. It does mean, though, that while you're typing an answer to something, somebody else will put something in above you, and it makes it less easy to follow the thread. The other alternative we use is the forum style, where it's more like a bulletin board and they can thread the discussions. And particularly when we give them one that's done over time, that makes more sense, and it's much easier for me to read because it's all grouped nicely.
And the last one is much easier to read than, say, Blackboard.
Yes, and that's another issue. Why don't we just do this in Blackboard because all the tools are there? It seems to boil down to me the sequencing thing. I can remind the students at the beginning, this is the question, this is what you are doing. Then we go into the chat, then we can just move them through. So the sequencing thing does make a big deal.
And so the students don't complain about the the way they have to use the chat, for example? Do they complain to you and say, why can't we use something they use all the time? Like,
actually, I've never had it. Have you ever had them complain?
So they don't have any trouble taking out that sort of technology?
No, not at all. The older ones do find that the chat, the synchronous chat, they have a bit of trouble keeping up with. I guess I probably would too. But the younger ones love it because it's totally familiar to them. They don't have, and they don't have general problems with the rest of the tools that are used either.
I always recommend to actors that they start using chat to tell the private room.
Yes. The first time we did this, we had three discussions, and the students really got into it. So instead of little lines of chat, we had paragraphs of chat that sometimes they'd prepared beforehand. And it was, I just remember Nick and I spending hours marking this, and we said, great assignment. It was the best quality work we had ever, ever got out of the students. And we had this, we were torn, thinking this is exactly what we wanted, but we can't stand it. We just can't do this again. So what we did now is we get the students to mark themselves. So they submit a paper giving us evidence from their chat where they use these particular things. So in the end, what we did is we've taken those chats and got the students to self-assess where they believe they've used higher order thinking or whatever it is that we're using, and pull that through so that we're now marking a quite succinct report, if you like, even though they've done all of this. So that's just this thing that keeps evolving, because nothing was ever as good as that first time, because they knew we were marking every word they wrote. But it was unsustainable. We've got a course that's got 200 students in it, and we just died. So yeah, we knew it was worthwhile. We knew that what we were doing versus the class discussion was just so far superior, but it was the marking that was killing us. So this seemed to be quite a reasonable compromise, even though we all admit that the quality just, it did drop. Oh, with some students, that's a gross exaggeration, yeah. It wasn't with all students, but with some students, when they knew you weren't marking every word, they slacked off a bit. But they are required to do a succinct report now. 750 words, so it's much more manageable. In total. Okay, so has anyone got any other questions, or I can move on to our next group? Yeah?
How do students use Lands at home, or do they use it, or can they only use it?
It's just a URL, so they can use it wherever they like. Yep, so they access it.
So you buy the license, you buy Covered
Land. It's open source. So they don't have to pay anything. And they just have a login, they type into a URL, it puts them through to our server here, and they just do it the same way.
So they store it on the Macquarie server.
That's right, yeah. But in the schools that some of them are visiting, the schools have chosen to load it onto their server, so they just use the school server when they're at school. So because it's all through URL, it's really not an issue. Accessibility is not a problem. Okay, thank you. Now we'll just have a bit of a changeover.